with our Bible verse for the week.
Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
I feel very fortunate to have this guest for this hour, Mary Rathke, who lives near Bay City, Michigan, with her family, four children, is the president of Help People Incorporated. And she is a wife, a mother, a licensed minister, speaks monthly at the Good Samaritan Rescue Mission Chapel there. Her story, however, is one of great challenge, to say the least. She is the adopted daughter who was adopted to a woman who herself had problems, but the mother who gave her birth conceived her from a rape. And part of Mary's ministry has been to talk about rape, rape victims, the children conceived by rape, and she addresses what she calls the confused compassion that surrounds the issue of rape and pregnancy. She has several other major challenges that she has faced in her life, and including her adopted mother as well as her birth mother. We're going to talk about all that in the following hour. Mary, I guess the first question I want to ask you is this. You know, a lot of presidential candidates and political candidates, you know, when they're calling themselves pro-life, they always feel like it's totally acceptable to include, you know, the rape exception. And I guess you're living proof that that exception is not, should not be so immediately accepted as it has come to be. Is that the case?
Yes, that's so true. I always hear people say, I'm pro-life except in the case of Mary Rathke. I don't have them
say. that's making it personal, Mary.
It really is. But I do. I try to explain it as confused compassion because their statement is saying, I'm compassionate to the woman who was raped, and I don't want to force her to have this rapist baby. But what they forget is I'm also the mother's child, and ultimately I'm a child of God.
I remember talking to President Bush about this personally, and he said, you know, Teal, I know that it's a contradiction. I know it's a contradiction that there, life is life, and there shouldn't be any exceptions. He didn't come out and say it, but I think he was implying that it's just become a position that politicians take, because to say that they're still for abortion in the case of rape and incest makes them look like an anti-abortion extremist. How do you find that your story that you tell impacts not pro-lifers, but those who are for abortion?
Well, unfortunately, those who are for abortion don't see the value of the unborn. So they have a harder time accepting even my story. It kind of irritates some of them. They're really advocates for abortion. And I've received hate mail over the years that just say, you know, you should have been aborted. Your mom made the wrong decision.
Are you kidding me?
No.
And they say that because you're a prominent pro-life advocate, and they say you should have been aborted?
I assume so. I mean, they'll make statements that, you know, your mother shouldn't have had to cure you. What they're forgetting, though, is that pregnancy is temporary. By the time the woman finds out she's pregnant after the rape has occurred, she's already a mother. She's already conceived. You know, you can't change that. The abortion does not take the memories of the rape away. It only ends a life.
Can you tell us why your mother, your birth mother, chose not to have an abortion?
Well, she is Catholic, and she saw that, you know, that she was pregnant, that it is a life, and she just was not going to choose abortion. Her husband, at the time, also supported her decision, and so he just kind of covered over the fact after they had gone to the police and reported the rape and the assault. When they found out she was pregnant, they just, you know, told everybody in town that they were having a child.
But your my impression is from reading your story is that it did have an impact on your mother emotionally and psychologically.
Well, she already was schizophrenic, and she still is. She's still alive. And unfortunately, because of her mental illness, after I was born, she was unable to care for me. She that was about the time in the late 70s when they still had the state mental hospitals, and so the doctors had made the decision to keep her at the state mental hospital for observation after I was born. So they were going to send me home with her husband. Now, the two of them had kind of paired up together because he was also a little bit developmentally delayed. He didn't drive. So he had asked his boss, a restaurant owner, to take him to the hospital to see her and to see me after I had been born. And so the decision was made that the restaurant owner, her name was Ursula, would bring me home and care for me until Margaret was able to.
And so, did she end up adopting you?
She did when I was 5 years old.
Wow.
So for about the first 5 years of my life, the state would step in and they would try to have my birth mother care for me, but because of her mental illness, you know, it just wouldn't go well. They would call up Ursula and they would say, you know, Mary won't stop crying, you don't know what to do. And so Ursula would show up at the house and would find that all the bottles she had left or, you know, the
from drinking
that she had left weren't being used.
Drinking?
No, the baby bottle.
Oh, you weren't getting fed?
No, I wasn't being fed, and my pants weren't being changed. Unfortunately, because of Margaret's mental illness and because of her husband's delay, they just would leave me in the crib to cry.
Oh, Lord.
And so they finally made the decision to invite Margaret into their home. So my adoptive parents invited her into the home and made up a room for her.
I must say, Mary, I'm talking to Mary Rathke, listeners, it sounds like your adoptive parents are really amazing people.
They really did try very much to keep me with my birth mother. They tried to teach her how to be a mother, but unfortunately, after a week, she just abandoned me there and left.
Oh, she only lasted a week.
Yep, she lasted a week.
And how did you, it sounds to me like you still have a relationship with her, is that correct?
Well, because it was an open adoption, I mean, even before I was adopted when I was five, my parents, the night before, you know, went over everything with me, and I knew who they were in town, and obviously as a five-year-old, when I would see them in town, they just seemed funny, you know, they just seemed odd because of their mental abilities, and so I wanted to be with my adopted parents. And so as an adult, as, you know, I write her letters, I stop to visit. Her husband has since passed away. And it wasn't actually until he died that his family members came forward and explained to me about her being raped and how he had covered the fact that she had been raped the whole time.
So you spent the rest of your youth and teenage years with your adopted parents?
That's correct.
And tell us a little bit about your life going forward from there, because we want to come back to the issue of rape and the what your mother went through, your birth mother. But we also want to talk about what happened to your adopted mother.
Well, my adopted mother was actually 50 years old when I was born. And you might think it's strange that a 50-year-old woman would agree to bring home this little baby and kind of involve herself in this whole deal of raising a child and trying to help the birth mother. But really, for her, it was a healing time because she came to America as a war bride when she was 19 years old and married a man, and they had five children, and four of them actually were killed in an accident. They had gone up north and had gone to a cabin, and the carbon monoxide leaked out of the refrigerator. They had just installed a new refrigerator. And so the next morning when they woke up, well, they didn't wake up. The owners of the cabin realized they weren't coming out, and they went to check on them, and they found four of the five children already passed away, and my mother and her husband at the time and my one brother who survived were taken to the hospital. And it was a very sad time for her life.
Yeah.
She ultimately ended up getting a divorce and remarried years later, and they tried to have children and couldn't. So when I was kind of placed into their lives at her age of 50, it was kind of a sweet moment for her to have a child to care for again.
Well, I adopted my son at age 50, even though the Catholic Adoption Service tried to keep me from doing it, said I was too old. And so I must say that it's the best thing I ever did. And I'm sorry to hear, though, that your adopted mother went through so much and eventually got divorced. How did that impact you?
Well, this had happened before I was born, and so as a young child, when I grew up hearing about that story, you know, it was kind of hard to understand as a young girl, but then as the older I got, as a young woman starting my family, you know, I just realized I can't even imagine the tragedy of what she would have gone through. And even, you know, being willing to take me into her life, because until they finally legally adopted me, at any time the state or my birth parents could have taken me away and she would have had to go through that, you know, loss again of losing a child. But she was willing to do that to give me a good and happy life. I often tell people when a child is adopted, they're not given away. They're given a family. And I was given the best mother in the world.
Well, your life has at least appears to have thrived in spite of all these rather negative, to say the least, experiences growing up. Have you felt many aftershocks from what you went through?
I believe that I've experienced just compassion and mercy for people that find themselves in hard situations. I believe that being raised as a Christian, I found my identity in being a child of God and not really looking at how the world views me. You know, the world might say, oh, you're the daughter of a crazy lady, or, oh, you were given away, or you were abandoned, or you are the daughter of a rapist. But I don't look at what the world's perspective is. I look at God's perspective. And he said I was created for a purpose and for this time and place. And so I'm just honored to be able to share the testimony and to encourage others that it doesn't matter where your beginnings are, God has a great finish in store for you.
Well, Marietta, you also do more than pro-life work. You actually work with those who are vulnerable to homelessness. You volunteer at the local homeless shelter. Now, has your organization helped people directed toward this group of people?
Well, we started to help people after I began doing large-scale fundraisers. So under the umbrella of Help People, we've raised over $70,000 for the local homeless shelter. We've raised money just to kind of help people that are in a situation where maybe their heat's been shut off or their water's been shut off. And so we can help them out if they've exhausted all other resources. Once I began volunteering in the homeless shelter, I was surprised to find sometimes people have homes, but their water has been shut off and they have children and they can no longer stay in their home. And so they need extra resources to kind of help with those emergency type situations. So we created Help People, which means heal, educate, and love people.
You know, water is not that expensive, Mary. I mean, my water bill every year is about, what, $300 or something? How do people get their water turned off? I mean, this seems kind of heartless from those who, you know, turn it off.
It does seem heartless. And, you know, in certain areas in the state, you might have water that's really inexpensive. And then you might be more in a city area where you're not only paying for water, but you're paying for the sewer. And surprisingly, the water bills can get kind of high. And unfortunately, if you go so many months without paying it, you know, you get that shut off notice. And it is sad to hear these stories, but they do happen here in the United States.
Wow. And so these are people who wouldn't be in the homeless shelter if it were not for the fact that their water or their electricity was cut off.
That's correct. I mean, you have some people that will stay in their home without water or electricity, but if children are involved and the state finds out, that can become an issue to have your children removed from the home. So they would rather move the family to the shelter, and then that way they can all stay together.
You know, you're a very good example of what I try to tell people who accuse our crowd of being one-issue voters or one-issue only. You're obviously, your concern for human life extends beyond the womb, as it were, and beyond the issue of abortion to their just general well-being. Is this something that you felt sort of naturally all along, or is it something that you came to over time?
Well, I've had people accuse me of that. You know, they'll come to my ministry page or they'll hear me speak on pro-life issues, and they say, well, what about after they're born?
Right.
And I say, you know what, we support a local pregnancy care center. We support the local homeless shelter. And really, we're just being what Jesus wants us to be, his hands and feet. He tells us in Matthew 25:31-46, he said that, you know, you gave me food, you clothed me, you cared for me. And they said, when did we do that, Jesus? And he says, you did it when you did it for the least of these. And so for me, when I read my Bible, I see that the Lord tells us that we need to care for those in these situations. And so I'm not going to just say I'm a Christian. I'm going to actually be a Christian.
I've heard over the years, and I don't know if it's true, that the actor Jack Nicholson was conceived by a rape, and that he has been quietly pro-life for most of his life. Do you know whether that's true or not?
You know, I'm not 100% sure with Jack Nichols. I know he is
Nicholson.
Nicholson, yes. And I also know there are lots of other actresses and actors and just famous people that were conceived in rape. And it really, you'd be surprised. We think that it's just unheard of, but really it's about 1% of, you know, statistically of the births out there. Surprisingly, I get a lot of messages privately from women who are, you know, maybe confessing for the first time that they conceived their child in rape, or, you know, that they were raped while they were in college and they had their children, or, you know, or sometimes they had an abortion and how they regret it. But it does happen more often than we realize.
Well, I've confirmed it. I found a story on the Christian News Service. This was just for a few years ago. He says, I'm positively against abortion. I never would have gotten to live because he was conceived in rape. He's also raised Catholic in New Jersey. It's interesting that it didn't hurt his career.
Oh, no. And I think that it really is your attitude about what has happened. I think all of our parents have sins that we don't know about. Some of them obviously have hurt other people more. But, you know, we can't define our life based on theirs. We have to find our own way.
How many, I don't mean to give me an exact number, but how often do you come across someone who has been conceived in rape?
You know, typically every event where I go and speak, I have at least one person come up and tell me their story. And it's either about a grandchild being conceived in rape, or them being raped, or them being conceived in rape. So it really is a lot. I mean, and on a monthly basis, a weekly basis, sometimes on, you know, my social media or website, do I get contacted from people. I have a friend who has been speaking publicly on this subject for many more years than I have, and she has a list of over 200 people that have, you know, okayed her having their name and address and contact information that she has met over the years.
I'm noticing also that Jesse Jackson, the black activist, was conceived in rape, as was Eartha Kitt, the very famous black singer and actress, and also one of Angelina Jolie's and Brad Pitt's adopted daughters was born, conceived in rape. So it's nice to see that, you know, there isn't a blanket attitude toward children conceived by rape. It seems to be that it's out there and it's not being completely glossed over. Do you find openness toward your message among people? Probably, have people really thought about it very deeply at all?
You know, it's the number one thing that pro-choice people will throw into the pro-life person's face when they talk about this. So it's always on the mind of a pro-life person. I don't know what to say. I don't know how to approach this. And so I usually, when I go to an event or I talk to people or I try to educate people, I try to give them the information. I tell them my story. Tell them my name, you know. And I find that by telling a real life story, it makes all the difference in the world. I've been asked to speak at press conferences here in the state of Michigan when they've tried to pass laws that deal with pro-life issues. And those on the left begin to yell out in the House of Representatives and different things, and they'll say, what about in cases of rape? And so the Republicans will bring us in, we'll do a press conference, we'll tell our stories, and immediately those on the left stop saying that, and they pass the bill without any exceptions.
So nobody...
Never.
You don't find that people stand up and face-to-face with you say, well, I'm for abortion in the case of rape, even though you survived.
I've never had anybody be, you know, in my face like that. I've had people who are pro-choice say, well, I'm glad your mother made that choice, but I still believe, you know, abortion should be legal in all cases.
Well, how can they justify that? I mean, what is the most common argument that people give to say abortion should be morally or legally justified in the case of rape?
Well, like I said, pro-lifers, as soon as they hear my story, they decide to be pro-life for all. Pro-choicers just continue to hold their stance that, you know, it's they believe it's the woman's choice. You know, I like to point out to them, I say, but it's her choice to do what? You know, they don't want to actually talk about what they're saying she has a choice to make. But I find that my target audience really isn't the pro-choicers. It really is the pro-lifers who, statistically, about 60% of them believe in that exception. But after they hear me speak, only about 1% of them walk away.
Yeah, that's my impression, Mary, that pro-lifers haven't thought too deeply about it because they've never been confronted with it.
Right.
And what have you ever come into contact with incest, the incest situation of someone being conceived that way?
Yes, I actually, through the organization Save the One that I'm a part of, I know of a few incest survivors. They were conceived typically when their grandfather raped their mother, which made him their father. And I try to explain this to people. I said, you know, I've done the research and, you know, when someone is conceived in incest, there is a higher rate of birth defects, but it's typically like blood defects, you know, it's some sort of maybe a disease or something like that. But a lot of people are born with different types of genetic diseases.
All the royal families of Europe qualify.
Exactly. Right.
You know, that's how they develop their blood disorders. For example, the son of Tsar Nicholas II.
Exactly. And we need to talk about it because people think that, well, if you're conceived in incest, that means you're going to have some horrible, disfiguring disability. And they really need to be educated to say, yes, you know, statistically they may have more of a chance of a blood disease, but they're still alive. They're still already here. They're already created. And when the incest survivors are just rushed in for an abortion, it really covers up what the perpetrator is doing. And so by saying that abortion is not allowed in any case, these girls will have their pregnancy. It will be made known what is happening in the home, and they will receive help. And in many cases, that was the only way the woman did get help was when she became pregnant.
Now, would incest be properly described as rape plus? it's rape plus the issue of being raped by a family member?
Yeah, they do call it rape because, you know, the woman is, you know, or child is not engaging in this consensually.
But it gives the pro-choicers another angle to argue against it based upon the potential of birth defects.
That is what they say, but they'll also say that with, you know, Down syndrome and other disorders. And I always explain, when do we draw the line? If I know that my child's going to have type 1 diabetes, am I going to say, oh, you know, I better abort this baby because they're going to have to deal with insulin the rest of their life? You know, what if they're going to have high cholesterol when they're an adult? What if they're going to be prone to having breast cancer? You know, we can't use these disabilities as a reason to abort a child. You really, really, really need to stand for all life, no matter what.
I'm talking to Mary Rathke. Mary, you also had the challenge of your first child was born 1 pound and 8 ounces. How did you handle that?
Well, when I was pregnant with him and began having problems, the first thing the doctors say is, we can end this. You know, he's going to be born premature. He's going to have developmental delays. So we can just end this. And I really just stood on, you know, God's word and just said that every life matters, even his. And so even as he was being born, another doctor suggested we just let him die, and I asked for all medical care to be used. And he's now 16 and doing great. He's a lifeguard and an honorary student.
Oh, that's great. He's a strong young man then.
He is. He's wonderful. He's a blessing, and he wants to be a pharmacist when he grows up.
That's great. I'm talking Mary Rathke. She was conceived in rape. She now stands up for the life of those conceived by rape and incest. And we'll be back to talk to Mary Rathke some more after this short break.
The Holy Trinity Apostles Lenten Symposium is Saturday, March 12th, and this year's theme is the Jubilee Year of Mercy. Auxiliary Bishop of Detroit, the Most Reverend Arturo Cepeda, is one of this year's keynote speakers.
To hear the word, become the Word, and proclaim the Word.
Father Roger J. Landry, National Chaplain of Catholic Voices, comes from Washington, D.C.
If the church could have only one or the other for a generation, either solid preaching but no access to the sacraments, or universal access to the sacraments but no or bad preaching, which would be more important to take?
Other speakers include Father Gregory Bromlich, Father Timothy Gallagher, Father Joseph Horn, Sister Yvonne Mary Lutz, and Patrick O'Meara. The symposium is at St. Cyril and Methodius on Ryan and 18 Mile in Sterling Heights. There's a youth symposium for ages 14 to 17 led by Father Steve Matea. For ticket information, go to HolyTrinityApostolate.com and register. That's HolyTrinityApostolate.com.
Almost half the UN General Assembly complained to the Secretary General about the LGBT stance that the UN Secretariat issued 2 weeks ago. The Secretary General says he doesn't care. This is Austin Rusev, CFAM, for the UN Minute. The UN General Assembly has consistently rejected the LGBT agenda, including any redefinition of the family. The General Assembly has explicitly rejected the phrase sexual orientation and gender identity a whole bunch of times. Even so, the UN bureaucrats do exactly what they want. The most recent example is the LGBT stamps that celebrate homosexuality and even transgenderism. Delegations of at least 86 countries asked for their removal. Through a staff member, the Secretary General says the stamps are in line with the mandate of the UN Post Office and that they are part of a campaign to combat homophobia and transphobia. Sources tell us the UN member states are girding for battle. This is Austin Russo, CFAM, for the UN Minute. For more information, go to c-fam.org.
With Mary Rathke, who is a very courageous pro-life activist, speaker. She has created an organization called Help People. Not only helps those who are in situations where they are considering abortions, but also those who are vulnerable to becoming homeless and without water, electricity, and food to sustain them. Mary, I want to ask you, you obviously come in contact with a lot of men and women who were conceived in rape. Is it possible to generalize about their life experience that they've had?
Well, I'll say that pretty much all of them are very thankful to be alive, especially those of us like me who were born after Roe v. Wade, when they know it could have been legal to abort them. They're very thankful that their mothers chose life. I know of women who are raising their daughters for their children, and they're very delicate in explaining to their children what has happened. But I tell you what, those kids are the light of their life, and they're just so thankful that they were born. They are not thankful they were raped. They do not wish that anyone would go through that hard situation, but they're thankful for the child that they have. I know of other women who have been raped and who have done open adoptions. I had a lady send me pictures of her and her twins, and then pictures of the adopted parents and the twins, and then a picture of all of them together, the adopted mother and father and the woman who was raped holding the little babies. And, you know, really it's God who brought some beauty to these ashes. He's given them an oil of thankfulness in this miserable, miserable time. Now, I also know of adults who did not find out that they were conceived in rape until they were an adult. Maybe they were
back. Oh, they found out later on.
Yeah, you know, I've had a lot of adults who they wanted to find out their birth parents, you know, so they had petitioned maybe Catholic charities or services, adoption services, and got the judge to unseal the records, and they go in pursuit of the mothers and then find out that the mother had been raped. And, you know, some people kind of go through a crisis initially, kind of a sad time, but, you know, as they talk to the mothers or they really think about it, they're just so thankful that even though something horrible like that happened, that they were given life. And some of these cases, you know, a relationship is renewed and the mother is just looking at this child saying, wow, you know, they've grown, they've got a family now. You know, what I had to endure for 9 months has given them a lifetime and a legacy.
They probably have a very special sense of their gratitude for being alive. Is that correct?
I know I do. I really, really do. And when I talk to these people, you know, overwhelmingly, they're all so very thankful to have been born and to have been spared the horrors of abortion.
So how do you deal with politicians who, and most of them do, have their rape and incest exception? I mean, you obviously vote. You're obviously active in public life. Have you ever had a chance to talk to any of these politicians who hold these exceptions?
Well, I'm very fortunate to live in the state of Michigan, and Michigan has never passed a pro-life bill with an exception in it. And the Right to Life of Michigan does a really good job of educating all of the politicians at the state level. So I've had the privilege of going to legislative debates and going down there and chatting with them. And, you know, I tell them, thank you. You know, thank you for valuing my life. Actually, one of my representatives is a pro-life Democrat. And
When
one of the bills came through and those on the left really didn't want it to pass and they really wanted an exception in it, he stood his ground, and he was the only Democrat to vote for it. So, you know, I really thank him personally. And I've been invited to go down to, like, Ohio and testify when they had a heartbeat bill go through. And, again, those on the left wanted to add an exception. But when we came in and we told our stories, it was really interesting because even the Republicans who sponsored the bill were so shocked and surprised that the liberals really didn't have much to say. Because when you're standing there looking at me, you can't say, wow, this person shouldn't have the right to be alive. You know, I explain it to them. I say, you know, I'm a people group. My people group is those who are conceived in rape or incest, and legally you want to discriminate against me. You know, we say all men are created equal, but you're saying I'm not, and that I'm not equal under the law. And that
there was a situation last year when a West Virginia Republican congressman said, obviously, rape is awful, he said. But he said, what is beautiful is the child that could come from this. And he was just beaten up mercilessly for that comment. Do you think that was fair?
No, and actually I wrote a blog piece, and it was published in one of our pro-life online news medias. And I really came to his defense, and I said, you know what, you're my hero. You see the beauty in my life. And what I really think is happening nationwide is we're not being heard. When something happens at a state level, like Michigan or Ohio, they bring us in and we defend ourselves. When something happens nationally, everybody just kind of says, okay, we'll put the exception in. And they need to stop doing that. They need to start bringing us in. We need to hold the press conferences. We need the media to put the cameras on us and let us defend our own lives, because we're very articulate and we do a good job at defending our own bodies.
I've noticed recently, though, a few prominent pro-life politicians saying that they don't have any exceptions, and they sort of get away with it. I mean, they're so confident and so, I might say, principled and charitable in the way they say it, that it isn't that they don't seem to suffer from it the way they would have maybe 10 years ago.
I'm very, very proud of them, and I know even during this political season, I've been tweeting out lots of different ones. Even Dr. Carson, when he first kind of came on the scene, and I said,
yes,
hey, you know, defend my life. You know, I was conceived in rape. And I would love to believe that someone actually read him those tweets and showed him my picture.
Right.
And so when he is interviewed, as a doctor, he knows life is life. And they're not going to argue with somebody who's got the knowledge and the education that sees that. And I would hope that as they're being questioned, that they begin to tell our stories. Because I know it works when I'm in, you know, a conference, when I'm at a church or a parish, and I tell my story and I see my faith, they become pro-life for all. And so we really need that to happen on a national level.
You know, I think that most pro-life voters will accept the pro-life position of someone with these exceptions. But I've noticed that whenever in private conversations, whenever I've challenged anybody on them, they back down pretty quickly because they recognize the contradiction in their position.
Right.
But then they talk about pragmatism and so forth. Do you see the day when pro-life politicians will, as a group, adopt the no-exception position?
I do, and I believe that in Washington we have a lot of organizations that lobby on this issue, lobby on pro-life issues and family issues. And I believe that when laws are passed and they have an exception in it, when they come out and say, you know, we're thankful this pro-life was passed, however, it does have an exception in it, and we believe all life matters. When we begin to hear them speak out against these exceptions that are added to the laws, I believe the people are going to have their ears perk up, and the politicians are going to start to listen and say, okay, we made them almost happy, but we need to go 100% pro-life and defend all of them. So I believe the day is coming, but we just need to get our voices heard and educate more and more people at the national level.
I also notice when I look at some of the stories on this that there's a controversy or a debate about whether or not a child should be told that he or she was conceived in rape. What do you think?
I think that you need to tell the child as age appropriate. And there's a beautiful woman who just was part of a big commercial campaign here in Michigan with me, and her daughter's probably 10 or 11, and she's kind of explained it to her child as the age allows. So the little girl knows that she can't see her daddy, that her daddy was mean to her mommy, and, you know, that's why they don't see him. And that's about all she knows at this age. Now, I'm sure as she gets older, she will be told the truth. And, you know, I really do believe the truth will set you free, that, you know, we need to know the truth, that, you know, God said, thou shalt not lie, and there's a reason for that. But I do believe you need to make sure it's age appropriate.
I guess I want to ask you a question that's not directly related to your experience, but over the past year, as you know, there's been quite a bit of attention paid to rapes on college campuses. And in some cases, these charges of rape have been found to be bogus. What do you think is going on there? I mean, obviously there is rape, and obviously is sometimes fueled by alcohol or fueled, you know, who knows. But the culture of campuses can become very corrupt. But what do you think is going on in all of these cases where universities act very quickly on accusations that are fairly flimsy?
Well, I think, you know, it's part of this culture of being politically correct. As soon as, you know, a woman expresses the fact that she's been raped, and you see this in the pro-life movement, this compassion rises up in people, because to rape somebody is the most degrading thing you can do to a person. It's something, you know, that they don't want. And so the campus is always going to, you know, kind of go on the air of caution and investigate and be very thorough and be very abrupt with punishments and that, because they don't want to encourage that in other cases. But obviously, whenever it's something that was not true, you know, that needs to be taken care of just as quickly, just as with as much authority as they would have if somebody did rape, so that, again, we don't encourage other, you know, women to make these false claims, because we know it can ruin a young man's life.
Well, completely, especially in the age of the Internet.
Oh, it's horrible.
So you, as someone who's been touched personally by rape, you don't feel strongly that this, I'm going to call it a witch hunt, I'm not sure if it is, but I'll just say that, should be pursued on college campuses?
The witch hunt on the women that are making these bogus claims?
Yes, yes.
Oh, I think that it needs to be dealt with just as swiftly and as justly as if it was a man raping a woman, because these women cannot make these claims and have it ruin these young men's lives. I think that it should be pursued with the same vigor as if, you know, if they were the rapist.
And what is it legally that defines a rape? Is it just simple? What do you know what the legal terms are that define rape?
You know, I'm not sure on that.
Is it unwanted, or is it a lack of agreement? I'm sure there's some legal term. Non-permission, perhaps. Or agreeing to do this thing. Aren't the kind of rapes that you deal with and the kinds of situations you deal with, are these mostly violent, kind of black and white situations?
You know, some cases are very clear cut, you know, violent acts. Someone is, you know, kidnapped and their clothes are cut off them and they are raped and, you know, they're found the next day beaten up, and it's very clear cut. In other cases, it's, you know, somebody they know. Maybe it's a coworker. Maybe somebody says, hey, you know, can I come over and, you know, borrow something? And the next thing you know, they're being thrown on the bed and they're being raped. And you find today more of these women are immediately seeking out and going to the authorities and saying, this person raped me. I did not want this to happen to me. But what we find in the cases that happened 30 years ago, 40 years ago, a lot of times those women were so ashamed
right.
of what happened, they kind of covered it up, or they, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's the good side of what's going on. In other words, we've created a greater willingness for women to come forward when they really have been raped.
Exactly.
You know, and
but it is something they can talk about.
Right.
And it's, you know, seen much more in society. It's not the woman's fault. Oh, she shouldn't have worn that outfit. No means no.
The women who have been raped, talk about the scarring that occurs.
One woman that I had the privilege of being interviewed with and had a chance to talk with her talks about it being a death. You know, she said that it just felt like a death, and, you know, it couldn't sleep, and it just, just being something, just something so horrible that happened to her. And she said that actually it wasn't until she found out she was pregnant and, you know, she was receiving doctor care after this had happened and she saw that heartbeat that she finally, like, stopped looking back at the rape, but instead looked to the future at the birth of the child. And she said she really felt like a bad rape victim at that point because society says, of course you would want to abort this baby. Of course you would want to carry the rapist baby. And, you know, we are led to assume that we have to keep it legal in cases of rape because that's the first thing the woman's going to want to do. But statistically, we find that women who were raped are less likely to receive an abortion than even those who
have
normal unplanned pregnancy.
Really?
Yes.
That is real. That's so interesting. So the percentage of women who are raped and conceive and have abortions is lower than those who are not raped.
Right, that are just a normal unplanned.
How do you explain that?
You know, like this woman described, it was the first time she could look forward in her life instead of being locked in the trauma of the rape and keep looking backwards. So we find about 50% of these women choose adoption, and today more of these cases are open adoptions. About 25% of these women are raising their children, and about 25% of them do choose abortion.
I find that's just remarkable and a very happy a fact to find out about. I'm sure our listeners agree.
Yeah.
Do you think that percentage will continue to go down as folks like you are out there talking about it, being visible regionally and nationally?
I hope so. You know, I really, the greatest groups I love speaking to are the high schoolers, you know, and I'm really open with the young people and talk to them. And, you know, I mean, I don't wish any of them to have been raped, but I do explain to them that they need to remember, if it ever does happen, that pregnancy is temporary. It only lasts 9 months. And I think with this modern age, they've seen so many ultrasounds. They know they know that it's a baby. They know that that heart is beating at a very, very early time. Most of the time, by the time they find out they're pregnant, that heart is already beating. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I believe that they're seeing something good can come out of it. And I just pray that more and more people embrace life for everyone.
Mary, many, many years ago, I was teaching at a college in Atlanta, and a student who I knew quite well came to me and said that she had been raped and was pregnant and was going to get an abortion. And I asked her to come in and talk to me, and I basically said, why do you want to take out this act of violence on your child? Child has nothing to do with it. I mean, I'm sure this is exactly what you say to people. And I was very surprised to see this young woman completely go silent. She hadn't even thought about that she was doing that. Well, that boy is now 25 years old. And her parents are, who I knew both of them, they're both very happy. I mean, he repented of what he did, you know, and it took a long time for her to accept his repentance. But I think that having you, Mary Rathke, and others out there posing these hard questions to people who can think there's only one, like you say, there's only one choice. Of course you're getting an abortion. Is having a real impact.
I hope so. I know that, you know, it says in Psalms, let the redeemed tell their story. And, you know, I've been redeemed from the curse of death, and I'm just so thankful to be alive. And I really want people to understand that when a woman is raped and she conceives a child, there's now two victims. And we never in society kill one victim to make the other one feel better.
Right. Now, you have four children. Do you have any girls?
I have two girls and I have two boys.
And how old are your girls?
My oldest girl is 15 and my youngest is 6.
Well, your 15-year-old, obviously she's heard you talk about this publicly. How does she react to it?
She's just thankful that I'm alive, you know. That's what happens with a legacy. You know, if if I hadn't been born, they wouldn't have been born.
Right.
And so they're proud of me to speak out for life. And, you know, we've talked about all these different what-if situations. And
yeah, that's a whole, in fact, Mary, that's a whole other dimension of this, because there's a whole lifeline involved, right?
That's,
you know, not just you, but your kids and their kids. An abortion would have wiped all of you out.
That is correct.
And it's sort of like It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, think of what had been missing from human existence if you had not existed. The impact of Ray Rathke, your family, all that happiness, and all the life that will come out of your four children, and the happiness and the goodness, all that would have never happened.
It is really dynamic when you think about it.
It really is. But then, of course, not just in the case of abortion conceived in rape, but all abortion is basically doing the same thing. It's deleting existence that would have otherwise lived and bore its own fruit toward the future. And it's as if we're not just cutting down trees, we're tearing up the roots of human life so that nothing will grow in that place. And nothing will ever grow in that place, because all the life that was in that place has been taken away and there's nothing left to bear fruit.
Yes, and that brings us then to the other type of people I encounter. I have those who have had abortion come up to me and, you know, talk about the loss and the trauma and how the hard time they have forgiving themselves. And I try to direct them to Jesus and to forgiveness and learning how to forgive themselves. And many of them now go and speak out. They're silent no more. And they talk about, you know, the healing that they received, but the trauma they went through and how they wish that nobody would make the same mistake they did. And so they speak out and try to educate young women. And I think that's an important piece as well, that we extend forgiveness to those who have had an abortion, but let them be the ones that educate them and talk to these young girls about why they should not walk down that path and why their child deserves life.
Mary Rathke, we have a few minutes left. How can people read more about you and your work, help people? Do you have a website?
I do. I have a website. It's MaryRathke.com, and that's R-A-T-H-K-E. And I'm also a member of SaveTheOne.com, and that is the number one. And that's an organization of other people who have been conceived in rape or conceived in incest, or mothers from rape or incest. And there's plenty of different stories and links to different YouTube videos, and they can hear more about people who have gone through this.
And I assume your website allows people to get in contact with you personally?
Yes, my email address is on there. They can even just email info@maryrathke.com. I have a Facebook page and a Twitter and all the social media outlets. Most people that want to find me can, and even if you just Google my name, different YouTube videos and interviews over the years pop up, and there's a lot of information out there.
Well, I'm so glad that you've been on Church and Culture today, and I think you're apostolate, as we Catholics call it. I'm an ex-Baptist, so I know that's not the word you use. And I'm adding you as a friend as we speak, by the way, is a very, very important one, and it gets at one of the deepest tragedies that any woman can experience, and that is of being forcibly raped. I want to thank you for being on Church and Culture today, and we all wish you well in your ministry and in the work you're doing. It's so very important. I want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So Mary Rathke is going to be on Church and Culture this coming weekend, this interview, and I know that our listeners who are hearing it will appreciate everything that she does to protect innocent life. Thank you again, Mary. Thanks for being on Church and Culture.
Thank you.
And for all of you who've been listening, join us this time on this day next week for more very, very interesting guests.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
Old St. Patrick's Catholic Church on Whitmore Lake Road in Ann Arbor has been serving fresh, beer-battered Alaskan pollock on Fridays in Lent for over 30 years. We know how to make delicious fish and chips, and we'll tell you it's the best. But you don't have to take our word for it. Come on in and try it for yourself. We offer three choices of potatoes, or, if you like, mac and cheese. Graze at our salad bar. Don't forget your dinner roll, beverages, and even pie. Come on by and bring your family and friends to this beautiful place in the country, just north of Ann Arbor. While you're there, you can stop by our historic church and spend some time with the Lord, talking and listening to Him, or join us for the Stations of the Cross later in the evening. You can find out more information and directions at our website, www.stpatrickA2.org. That's www.stpatrick2.org. And we'll save a plate for you.
Hi, I'm Peggy Stanton, and I'm inviting you to join me on Power from the Pews when I interview the people who are engaged in remarkable ministries that are making a real difference in their parishes and the world. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
One of the greatest gifts God has given to us is wisdom. According to the Catechism, wisdom is a spiritual gift which enables one to know the purpose and the plan of God. So how do we obtain this wisdom for our lives? In a dozen places, the Old Testament tells us the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Fear of the Lord means being humble before God. St. James tells us that we can likewise approach God in humbleness, seeking wisdom. He wrote, "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask God." Let us pray that when we do not know the right direction to go or the course of action to take, we will humble ourselves and trust that God will give us the wisdom we need for the situation at hand. This message is brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan. You can find us on Facebook or at cbsmich.org.
This is Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life. One of the saddest scenes outside an abortion mill is when a girl's father or mother are dragging her in for an abortion. Not only does such coercion break multiple laws, kill a baby, and wound that baby's mother, but it also inflicts a deep wound on those parents. They dehumanize themselves and contradict their vocation as parents and grandparents by insisting on the death of their grandchild. So many grandparents need healing from this deep wound. Many push it out of their minds, but they cannot push it out of their lives. The Silent No More initiative, called Healing the Shockwaves of Abortion, is focusing on grandparents in this month of March. We are educating people about their wounds and about the opportunities for healing. Learn more at abortionshockwaves.com. This is Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
Who is responsible for the death of Jesus? The Catholic Catechism emphatically states that neither the Jews of Jesus' time nor the Jews of our time should be considered